Hello, mead friends. Welcome to the Regenerative Mead Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Tice, and today Frank and I sit down with Brandon Uhl, our head brewer, to do a deep dive into what it means to balance the mead stool. We start off the conversation with defining the legs of the mead stool, then start to get into how to balance each leg properly in order to make a well-balanced mead. We then talk about the odd meads that don't really apply to the mead stool concept and how to think about those types of meads when it comes to brewing them and their final taste. Now let's get into it.
Hey everyone! Here at Golden Coast Mead, we consider drinking alcohol not only a luxury, but a celebration of life. If you partake in this celebration, we advocate for drinking regenerative mead made from real honey to help shift the $1.5 trillion alcohol industry in a better direction. When you drink our regenerative mead, you are helping to make the earth healthier, more biodiverse, and abundant. Drop monoculture-based booze and drink regenerative mead. Visit our website, www.goldencoastmead.com, to learn more about our regenerative mead business and be a part of the celebration. Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers, gentlemen.
How's everyone doing today?
Pretty well.
Got a delicious mead in my hand. Good to talk about mead with two cool guys.
We got Brandon, our head master brewer here.
Not master.
Mine's working on mastering.
I'm a master out of it.
We got Frank. And what are we drinking today?
Wildflower Sweet. It's our newest batch. I think it's delightful. It's got a nice honey character up front. And then a creamy kind of fermentation character. We use the Kveik. Mm-hmm. Scandinavian ale yeast.
Really nice aromas. Some floralness in there too.
And a little bit of like spice and phenolic characters that complement the honey. A little nice, warm, clean finish. I think it's solid. 12%, 12.5% mm-hmm. ABV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I forget exactly what the analysis said, but it was
12.56 or something, I think. Yeah. And then like 2% residual sugar. So not too sweet. Kind of more like a beer. Yeah. In terms of residual sugar.
Yeah. I mean, if this were a beer, you'd probably consider it a dry beer, but it definitely comes off as sweet and honey-like.
Yeah. So we're here to talk about the mead stool and balancing all the characteristics that make up a good mead, right?
Yes, we are. Do we want to start off with defining each leg of the stool?
I think that's key.
And talking about, I know you've mentioned in the past, GCM usually only uses three legs, but I've read and heard there's four legs, there's six legs, there's a lot of people out there.
That's a bench.
I know. Who have varying definitions of what constitutes good meat, I guess.
Cool. Yeah. And that's what makes it interesting. So my understanding of the mead stool is from Ken Schramm, the Complete Mead Maker. He talks about sweetness, of course, because we're working with honey. Alcohol, course, because we're fermenting that honey, then acid, which is naturally present in honey but can be increased through different techniques, and then tannin. And tannins are these classes of compounds that exist within plants. They're typically like in grape skins and wood, and they prevent insects from killing the plant or spoiling the fruit. But our body perceives them in different ways. One of the key ways that we do, like in a highly tannic wine, tannin actually gets into the parts of our tongue and membrane that senses liquid. So laying on top of that piece, our tongue perceives dryness when we literally have liquid in our mouth. Mm-hmm. And tannin creates a texture and a complexity that can make drinking a liquid be really dry and gritty and velvety, and all kinds of descriptors can come from different tannin additions in a mead.
Gotcha.
So I could dive deeper into sweetness, alcohol, and acidity. I guess I assume that most people know what that means, but if that's worth it.
Well, let's just give a quick review of what each of those are. So sweetness comes from the honey source essentially, and you want to balance that in the sense that you don't want it overly sweet and you
want sweetness within your mead, but you don't want no sweetness at all.
Yeah, maybe we should back up and talk about balancing the stool before we talk about the specific characteristics of those three aspects. So, like, the idea of a stool gives a very visual representation of the legs being close enough in size to one another that when the stool is set on the ground, it doesn't fall over, right? If one of the legs is too long, the other three are too short, the stool flips over. Mm-hmm. If one of the legs is too short, the other three try to keep the leg up or the stool up, but it tips. So you got to like find that balance point where the stool stands on its own. And now understanding your characteristics a little deeper in depth will help you visualize and embody a sense of where you want to go so that when you make these choices with your fermentation technology, you get to that end state. You have a higher likelihood of achieving that end state. So sweetness is really interesting because there's the actual sugar that's in the beverage. And that can be measured as residual sugar or Brix or specific gravity. And these are all different ways of talking about the density of the beverage. And while different things can change the density of the beverage, including alcohol, primarily we're talking about how much sugar is diluted in the liquid that changes that residual sugar, Brix, or specific gravity. But there's also perceived sweetness. So let's say that we take a glass of water and, you know, we're taking 100 milliliters of water and we're dissolving 100 grams of sugar in it. So like 1-to-1, right? It's going to be a very sweet beverage and we're going to taste it. We're just going to taste sugar up front. If you take that same 100 milliliters of water and you put 10 grams of sugar in there, then there's going to be some perceived sweetness. There's going to be some sugar and it's actual sugar, but it's a tenth of that 100 grams of sugar. Now, what's really interesting is if you put like a vanilla bean into 100 milligrams of water, it's not necessarily going to put sweetness into that 100 milliliters, of water. It's going to put these aromas of vanilla and vanillin and all the phenolics that are present in vanilla that our brain associates with sweetness. And when we taste that water, it's not going to taste like normal water. It's going to have this perceived sweetness to it. So when we think about sweetness, those are two important things to keep in mind is like actual residual dissolved sugar and then perceived sweetness. Gotcha. And since honey is so associated with sweet things, right? Flour, fruit, those caramel, toffee, like those kinds of flavors, our brain is usually associating sweetness with honey flavor profiles. So a relatively low sugar mead can have a lot of perceived sweetness because of that association in most people's brains.
That makes sense. And a lot of sweet meads out there have a higher sugar content in the end product than drier meads out there. And the way you balance sweet and dry meads is different because of that, correct?
Totally, totally.
Okay.
If you go into, okay, so maybe we should talk about alcohol and acidity and then we can talk about how you balance different styles. So alcohol is, you know, kind of intuitive, right? We all know like neutral grain alcohol, like Bacardi 151 or whatever terrible thing we drank earlier in our life. and it has some characteristics to it, right? Like pure ethanol, when you taste it, burns because your body's like, oh my God, this will kill me if I drink too much of it. So when it's diluted in water or blended into a mead, it at a certain threshold, it'll create some of those characteristics of heat and ethanol aromas. And then there are other alcohols that can be present as a byproduct of flawed fermentation, fusel alcohols like menthol and things that taste like rubbing alcohol or worse and make your eyes water as soon as you smell them and make your nose burn.
And you feel sick too.
Yeah, feel like woozy very quickly. So excluding all those undesirable kinds of alcohols, the desirable ethanol, which is a result of clean alcoholic fermentation, has these heat characteristics and spicy characteristics that are one aspect of the stool. And just imagine a little bit of alcohol with a little bit of honey, that can be a pleasant experience, right? Mm-hmm. So That's what we're talking about when we're talking about alcohol. And then acidity has a few different aspects too, right? It's that puckering factor. It's one of the basic flavors, but there are different kinds of acid. And primarily, we are talking about malic acid, which is like apple acids, citric acid, which is like citrus fruit acids, and then tartaric acid, which is grape acids. And it's pretty cool. Scientists can synthesize them, and then food companies can isolate them. So they take like citrus juice, remove all the sugar, and then turn the juice into a powder, and all you're left with basically is citric acid. And when you taste it, if you know what it is, you can taste the citrusy qualities of it. And if you compare it with malic acid, you can taste the apple-y qualities in the malic. And then tartaric acid, you can taste like grape skin, like gets you right here aspects of the tartaric acid. So they're all acids, and there's a bunch more than just those basic three, with, you know, lactic acid, like milk acid, whatever, what other kinds?
Those are the four I mainly.
Gluconic is present in honey in a lot of characters. That's why honey in its natural form kind of has a little bit of a bite on the back of your palate. So acid is present in food, and one of the aspects, right, if you balance sweet and tart, that can be pleasant. So now balance sweet, tart, and heat, and like you can start to imagine how they need to be relatively in harmony with one another without the other kicking the other two out or overshadowing the other two.
And is carbonic acid a
totally
big part of that too? Like, with, is it like, so we, our meats tend to have a little bit of carbonation.
And that's by choice,
yeah.
Because without them, the meat comes across less dynamic and bright and refreshing, right? Carbonic acid is because carbon dioxide is a negatively charged ion, and our tongues have these receptors for negatively charged ions and register it as tartness. So when you drink our mead carbonated versus not carbonated, they're going to have different flavor profiles. Just like drinking a soda between when it's bubbly and when it's flat, right? So carbonic acid is important. And tannin?
Yeah, we talked about tannin a little bit, but you can kind of dive into that a little bit more.
Yeah, so it's present in plants, like we said, and it can be soft and velvety. It can be rough and intense, like biting onto a grape stem, you know, and that juice comes out, and then you're like, oh God, why did I do that? And anywhere in between. And typically they come from fruit if you're using them naturally. There are tannin extracts, which are like a powder that you can throw in, but in my experience, those are really hard to integrate and do well. Barrel aging can add tannins to a beverage if the tannin hasn't been leached out by a beverage already and become neutral. So, and then you can add chips or cubes or staves, all different kinds of wood additions to add tannins. And there will also be other flavor components depending on the oak that you choose. Like American oak is famous for having vanillin, which is literally the compound in vanilla that makes it taste like vanilla. So we primarily focus on honey, alcohol, and acidity to create a balanced, dynamic, interesting mead. But there's a lot of ways to do it and a lot of room for innovation and creativity.
Is there a reason why at Golden Coast Mead we don't focus on tannins? Do you have experience that like has turned you away from it?
I think that the best tannins come from real fruit.
Okay.
Because they're the most full and the most easily integrated. But I find that when we do real fruit meads in a large volume, it totally distracts from honey, the honey focus of mead. Gotcha. And people get kind of confused and think of it as a fruit wine with honey added rather than a mead with fruit added. So they can be fantastic, and there are a lot of good ones in the world, but for our purposes of reintroducing mead to people, I think it's distracting.
Gotcha. So it kind of just distracts from the honey flavor, and you don't like taking away from what the honey is offering.
And the honey story.
Gotcha.
Like, people just are like, okay, so this is like a wine made with fruit and honey, and it's like,
there's so much more to it.
So the three-legged stool, is that show mead? Is just honey, water, yeast? Is there more to show mead?
So some people will add tannin and acid to show mead to bring out characteristics. And I've had really good ones that like truly masterful people have made, but they're really hard to find and they're hard to do at scale well. This is a show mead of just honey, water, and yeast, right? And I would say that if we were to pull it apart in terms of its stool, the sweetness is the key piece, with alcohol playing a background note of some heat and some like texture. And then the acidity is there as soon as it hits your tongue, right? That little prickle, a bubble, because we're at like 2.7 grams per liter CO2 or less. So you can't even see the bubbles, but when it's on your palate, it brightens up.
And this is right out of the filter, so it hasn't even
recharged.
There's no head pressure on the tank that this is going into
yet. Yeah, so there's a little bit of dissolved CO2 giving it some of that brightness. And actually, mechanically on your tongue, those CO2 bubbles coming out of solution and rising out of the liquid and then going into the air, that is then creating a negative space, right, as that bubble comes together and then floats off of your tongue, for liquid to come back onto your tongue. So you're getting multiple moments of sensation, which our brain registers as complexity and interest.
I was going to ask about that too, that the CO2 as a component as the acid leg and the alcohol as its leg, that the volatility of those two things allow the complexity to actually like be noticed.
Yeah.
You know, where if you could hypothetically take all the alcohol out of this, but everything else was the same, that it's not just that the alcohol would be missing, but that a lot of the other things that you smell would be
the interplay between them, because the alcohol dissolves these phenolic compounds and makes them available aromatically.
Right.
It's so cool.
That's interesting. So, I mean, so we do add acid though via CO2 to our meats.
Right. And it's like a natural byproduct, right? During the fermentation.
Yeah. So like we are adjusting the acid leg by adding the CO2.
Or letting it dissolve into solution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So does the CO2 and the alcohol having an effect on the other aspects, would increasing alcohol and increasing CO2 sort of have like a phantom effect of increasing another leg?
No, my experience with that, I mean, I don't know everything, so there's definitely room to be surprised here. But my experience is like, if alcohol and acidity are too high, it gets like abrasive. Whereas like, if you have a sweeter mead, it can now handle more alcohol and acidity, like that mead that we had earlier, 17%, but the sweetness is so high that it's like, where's the 17%?
Right.
So there are a lot of meaderies that are like rolling out high ABV meads, but the sweetness is so high, you don't even notice the, you know, high ABV.
So it's like 18% dry mead. Is that very unusual and seldom done?
Hard to do.
Yeah.
But it's theoretically possible. It would just need tannins. It would need the right acid balance. It would need the right perceived sweetness from a really clean fermentation that, you know, had some kind of floral or other characteristic that, like, when you drink this hot thing, it's pleasant. And then aging would, you know, imagine just a hot fermentation with very little honey character, and then not hot like fusel, but like just high alcohol, you know, 18% alcohol with no sweetness and then some acidity and no tannins. It's like, it's going to be drinking alcohol with a little bit of acid note.
All right. So I think that brings us to an important aspect of the mead stool, which is, if you're starting out, what are some like general industry practices that you know of, if you're trying to brew a balanced mead, what are the things people consider before you start your brew? Like you were just talking about, the sweeter the mead, it can handle more alcohol, essentially. That's something good to know before you brew it, essentially.
Right.
Is there anything else that you can think of?
Yeah, so kind of these guide rails of like, what's guidelines of success? And I think it's not written down. There's not this formula. That's like, if you want to achieve this outcome, these are where, you know, this outcome of alcohol, these are your acceptable ranges of sweetness, acid, tannin.
Yeah.
But like, based off of a lot of experience, I think we can kind of flesh out some guidelines that might be helpful to folks who are listening to this. So,
sure.
in our experience, like the Wildflower Sour is a great example of something that like was new, and we were like, oh no. And then we taste it and we're like, oh wow. You know, it's just good. And I think the acidity in that is high. Mm-hmm. Like there's definitely a pucker factor when you sip it and it's like, oh, that's tart. But then the honey comes in real quick, and then the alcohol and the honey start to weave together with the tartness, so that by the end you're like, oh, that was refreshing and I want more. So that end state is like some sense of balance where our brain is kind of like stimulated by all three of those legs of the stool in a dynamic kind of pattern that then kind of trails off in a pleasant way and leads you like, oh, I want more of that experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our sessions, I think, also kind of hit that where like the sweetness is low relative to a full stirring stuff, but the alcohol is also low and the acidity is also low. So like everything has been turned down. The stool has been shrunk, if you will, from this like normal stool to like a 1/3 of a stool,
mm-hmm.
which kind of makes sense because you're 12-ish alcohol here and now you're down at 5.5 alcohol here. When you drink this thing and there's some floral notes, there's some alcohol notes, and then there's some tart, bright, sweet dynamic, and then it goes away and it's very quick and short-lived, and that's suited for like, oh, it's the afternoon and I'm drinking this like low ABV thing, then I'm gonna be able to have some food and then drive away in half an hour or an hour and be totally safe, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I would say for new folks, like understanding what the end state that you have in mind is, and then what are the components that are going to result in that kind of balance, and how do you measure those? So pH is one way to measure acidity. TA, total acidity, is another way. And pH is relative, right? It's parts hydrogen relative to other things. So it's just crazy how we can measure that. It's like refraction with a diode. Whereas total acidity is like actual parts per million acid molecules within a solution, and you have to be able to titrate that. And those are both useful numbers, but you need TA when you're going for really high acid things and high sweetness things, because that's like the definitive measurement of how much acid is actually in there. And then making it palatable is finding that balance between that TA and that residual sweetness. And then alcohol, we know that by percentage. And you can just say that the more alcohol there is, the more heat there's going to be, and the more need there's going to be to balance that leg of the stool. So the general rules of thumb are, if you want to go really high on one of those aspects, you need to bring up the other two or three to create a balancing experience. If one of them's too high, it's going to be burny. If it's alcohol, it's going to be overly puckery. If it's acid, it's going to be overly tannic and gritty. If it's tannin, and it's going to be saccharine sweet and sticky and syrupy if it's sweetness. So if you're trying to amp up one, you can do bench trials where you like take your honey, you take some alcohol, you take water, and you mix them together just like that. And does that taste good at the final alcohol level that you want to arrive at? And if not, can you get some of those acids and drop them in there? Or can you carbonate it with the forced carbonation device like a SodaStream to create something interesting? And then of course when you ferment it, that's going to create a bunch of phenolics and esters that are not present when you're just doing this benchtop trial, but it will at least get you to the end state of like, okay, this alcohol level, this level of sweetness, this level of acidity results in something tasty or not.
That makes sense.
And then start small with equipment that's as close to the equipment you'll be making it as at scale as possible. So if you're going to be fermenting in stainless and temp controlled, then you want to be doing your trials in stainless and temp controlled.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So I think another thing to consider is like the act of fermentation creates and takes away some of the meat stool at once.
Mm.
And it's important to consider that when you're fermenting too, because you're creating CO2,
mm-hmm.
and you're creating more alcohol from the sugar,
mm-hmm.
and you're taking away sugar essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Is there...
And gluconic acid goes through like some weird curves as well.
Yeah. So is there anything you would recommend? Just get your ratios right, or what is your experience with like fermentation taking and adding to the stool?
Yeah, gosh. I mean, ideally it tastes good all the way through. That's the ideal, is that like every time you pull a sample and you do your measurements on it and you taste it, it tastes good. And if there's a point where it doesn't taste good, that's maybe an opportunity to improve your process and your recipe. Given though, there's like always kind of an awkward second, third phase where the alcohol starts to get high, the sugar starts to get low, the carbonation isn't like totally there. So in our experience, or the lactic acid bacteria hasn't totally kicked in and started creating lactic acid. And so it kind of like goes through these like funky teenage years, if you will, where it's like neither sweet enough to be tasty or integrated and complex enough to be tasty. And so you get this thing that's like kind of alcohol-y and not that honey-y. And you're like, oh God, I hope this makes it through. And then typically it does, as long as it's like clean and healthy through the fermentation, right?
Thank you. If you're raising your children right, they might have an awkward period, but you can be pretty sure they're going to get through it.
Yeah, exactly.
They might have a goth phase.
Punk phase. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Hopefully it's all productive. They're finding their own identity in yeah. that moment, yeah. and then it comes through.
As long as they get a job, they can,
they can figure it out from there. Yes, exactly.
That's fair. So is there anything, what are some major indicators when you're tasting mead that it's like in that teenage phase and you aren't too worried about it and you kind of just let it ride versus like, oh no, that's a flaw. I need to react quickly to it.
That's great. So what I was just describing of like awkward is it's like flat. It's like, oh, this isn't delightful, but it's not bad.
Gotcha.
Like bad is like, oh, this is starting to taste like burnt matchsticks and rotten eggs. It's like, oh, you have a sulfur problem and you need to get ahead of that, or otherwise it's going to turn into burnt rubber and that's going to be mercaptans. And then there's like nothing that you can do at that point. It's not true. There are things you can do, but it's like an ounce of prevention is worth 2 pounds of cure at that point. So you got to like dial in your temp. You got to, anyways, we're not talking about troubleshooting meads that are gone sulfury, but we are talking about what those aspects are that show you you're doing something wrong. So sulfury is one of the things. I think autolysis is something that a lot of people have where the yeast die and they start to degrade. And temp is, again, another huge piece. Like if you're fermenting at too high of a temperature, the yeast will die sooner, and then that'll be a part of the flavor profile earlier than it would be if you were fermenting cooler.
That's like a meaty flavor, right?
Meaty is one characteristic, or like Vegemite.
Yeah.
You know, like it's like you're just drinking something that's really yeasty and bitter. If you have any kind of microbial, like if you didn't have the right pitch rate and a healthy fermentation, then turns out meat is a great environment for other microbes to get in there and have a heyday and then start making nasty flavored compounds like mouse pee. Like there are, you know, mousiness is one characteristic, and apparently some people like it, which is weird, but mouse pee is a characteristic you can like taste and smell in mead, and it's the result of biological contamination. Cooked corn DMS is another one. Basically if there's anything in it that like makes people go, whoa, I don't know about that, versus like, oh, I can kind of get the honey and I get some alcohol and I get like something kind of flat and flabby. This isn't that interesting. Like this isn't that interesting during the awkward phase is much better than, oh God, like you're asking me to drink this?
That makes sense. So yeah. It's like a clear cut thing in your head where it's kind of like, this is like more muted, not as flavorful. But if it's tasting bad and it has those negative aspects, that's a much more concerning thing for you.
Totally.
Than the awkward teenage phase of mead.
Of me being like uninteresting, but not bad.
Yeah, and you just got to wait it out a little bit.
Yeah, I hopefully keep it on the track, yeah.
That makes sense. Okay.
What about the influence of the yeast itself that's just in solution? Where, I know that's part of the muting effect too, is the yeast. But then...
That deserves more explanation. Go for it. Like, what you mean by it, yeast presence muting flavor.
I guess it's because if it's a filtered mead like this, that you're tasting just the mead itself. And if you're tasting the pre-filtered mead with the yeast still in suspension, then a good portion of what's in your mouth is the actual yeast
cells.
So it's taking away, like literally physically taking away from the molecules that you would otherwise be tasting. But then also yeast has its own kind of flavor and mouthfeel, which can, you know, be good or bad depending. But, you know, one thing like I look at is it, as a mead's getting close to done, or a beer, because I have more experience with beer, is I kind of just know in my head what the yeast tastes like and what it's doing to it, where I can just go, okay, if that wasn't there, then how would this taste? And yes, it will be good. You know, and, you know, that's like, I'm not saying, oh, I have so much experience, but that's like a call you have to make all the time, like almost on a daily basis, where you're like, what are we going to do with this? Is this good if we filter it and go through the process of filtering it? Is it going to be good, or is there something else we need to do before we even get to
filter? You run this thought experiment of like sample with yeast minus yeast. Is it tasty?
Yeah.
And if you don't know what those yeast taste like, then you're not going to be able to make that thought experiment successfully. Yeah. But if you do, then you can remove it from what you're tasting and be like, cool, that's going to taste good without that.
Yeah. It's hard to explain without experience, but to me, it's like yeast just gives a little bit of a bitterness. It mutes the other flavors, and it changes the mouthfeel where it's not as sharp and
bright.
I think most people can relate to like the breadiness of yeast when you taste it too. It's like there is like a bready,
yeasty quality.
Yeah, to mead when there is yeast present, essentially.
That's great. Yeah.
So I think my next question goes to when do we, if we ever throw away the stool, and are there meads out there where it doesn't have to be perfectly balanced and you can have one leg super high or and the other things aren't existing? Is there anything out there you can speak of with that in your experience?
Yeah. So that's really interesting. So mead stool represents balance. And what happens if you want to do something that's like one aspect is just totally amped up and other aspects are not present? And I heard Ken Schramm talk about this at UC Davis early on in the courses that we give there, where it's like the stool is useful for, you know, 80, 90% of commercial meads. But there's going to be those few that like really hone in on some aspect. And one of the legs of the stool is going to be totally out of size balance with the other ones, but they're going to be in harmony. Like the alcohol, say you're using heather honey, which has this like citrus and herbaceous character to it. And you want to amplify that. So you want it to be relatively sweet. And you want that heather honey to be fully pronounced. If it doesn't have the right alcohol, heat, and backbone to it, it's going to kind of fall over, you know? But it's not saying that you have to have a lot, but you have to have enough to like match and amplify those herbaceous qualities, because that heat of the alcohol and the herbaceous heat of like spiciness that's from the heather will match together and then amplify the heather quality. And some acidity as well, right? Like without the acidity, the drink would just kind of be sweet and the citric quality of the heather honey would be muted. But with a little bit of acid, it's going to light that up. And like the acid leg of the stool is kind of going to be unnoticeable. But if it's not there at all, then the citrus piece of the heather honey isn't going to be there either. So understanding the harmony between the legs of the stool, if it's not totally balanced, is kind of the next level thinking. And
so like how do the other legs support the one leg you're trying to show?
Yeah.
And how do they play well together? If it's children on a playground and one person's taking all the attention, how are the other kids impacting them or bringing them to life?
Or like a team, right? Like you've got a star player. If he doesn't have other teammates, he's not gonna be able to play the whole game.
Yeah.
But if they're feeding the ball to him and playing the right plays, like bam, scoring every time, right?
You kind of a flavor that's the leader, but you don't want it to be a bully of everything else, where it's just the other children on the playground are being like held back.
Yeah. Crushed.
Suppressed.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly. And I was thinking that identify those things, bench trials are a really useful tool to, like, you've got your mostly finished mead. Now, what if we just do a little bit of acid versus a relatively moderate amount? And whenever you do acid additions with mead, like, you always start with a tenth of the recommended dose size, and then do like a fifth, and then like do a half, and do those bench trials. Because if you're going like full on, it's assuming the buffering capacity of wine, and the buffering capacity of mead is way lower, like we've talked about earlier. And you can also do this with tannin. You can also do it with neutral grain spirits and honey. But finding that harmonious balance between the complementary legs when you're trying to amplify a certain leg is a worthwhile exercise to help you then design your fermentation recipe to achieve that outcome.
Is there stylistic things where, you know, I know I always take it back to beer, but like IPA is not balanced on purpose, you know, so no one would really say like a super hoppy IPA is a balanced beer, but it's also like the most popular style now. So is there like an equivalent in mead, or like, you know, maybe another example is like gin, where it's like the juniper, like there's different kinds of gin, but if it's a London dry gin, like juniper jumps out, you know. And is there a style of mead where, yes, you do want those supporting flavors to hold up and be in harmony, but you are trying to show off one thing in particular that's so out of balance, but that's just the style that it is?
You know, I think our sour mead could be plugged into that, right? With our sour tartness being the longest leg in the stool, and the sweetness and the acidity, the sweetness and the alcohol complement it and balance it and make it interesting. But if you look at the three legs, like the tartness is relatively the longest. So in so much as we've created a style, that one, Schramm's meads, you know, are much longer on the sweet side. And sometimes he talks about his berry fruit meads, like the main point is the berries, and then the honey, the orange blossom honey and the alcohol are just there to create a background for the berries to just like slam people in the face, you know.
That sounds like a Moonlight's meads too to me.
Well, like, I think where Schramm really excels is that Moonlight, like the sweetness is muddled, whereas because maybe the acidity isn't quite as high, and so you taste them and you're like, oh, okay, I get berry and I get some honey and some alcohol, but it's like an 8 out of 10. Whereas you drink Schramm stuff and it's like, oh my gosh, I get so much berry, and then the honey comes in and then the alcohol comes in and it's like they're 9s and 10s out of 10, you know. And then that gap between 8 and 9 and then between 8 and 10 is a whole lot of work.
That makes sense. Is there anything else you want to cover when it comes to the mead stool and balancing those?
Yeah, I think a hedonistic response is a key metric or thing to pay attention to as you craft meads that are either balanced or not balanced. Is like, if a relatively new drinker tastes it, do they go, oh, wow, yeah. And like, I can't even explain why that's good, but I like it. Like, that's kind of desirable. Actually, it's very desirable. I think as our business has grown and the sour has become more and more a big part of what we do, more and more people know nothing about mead and they drink and they go, wow, what's that? Like, can I have more of that? And I was like, well, slow down. Like, let's talk about it first. Is an end state that you want to achieve is making new people wag their tails when they taste it.
Yeah, making it easier to enjoy just right off the bat.
Yeah.
And not having to explain what we just talked about to a new person.
Yeah, but okay, we're gonna talk 30 minutes about the mead stool and then you're gonna have your second taste.
I would want to hear you talk about how what we do and what new mead makers could maybe do themselves in terms of having objective criteria that are the like literal length of your legs, where it's like this leg is 8 inches and this leg is 8 inches and this leg is 8 inches, it's objectively balanced. But then what are the subjective things that we look for? And because we, you know, we have objective measurements of our meat and then we also taste it. And so where is that intersection?
Wow, that's a great question. And honestly, I mean, our mead sheets, we're starting to pin those things down. Mm-hmm. But as you've seen, like, Andrew's like, hey, Frank, is this within spec? You know, I was like, well, considering the 40 batches of that that we've done, yes, but the last 10 is a little out. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, we're trying to dial those things in. So we've got our starting bricks, right, which is a bit of like a measurement on the sweetness stool. And then we expect, you know, for the sweet, we start higher than for the dry or for the sour. So we do have those numbers dialed in. Mm-hmm. And then knowing our yeast and our yeast tolerance and our fermentation conditions and our nutrient load, we can expect that those fermentations will reach a certain point and then we'll cold crash them. So I think that's a really interesting question. I think there's room for us to improve, but I think that as people go down the professional mead making path, they're going to find the metrics that are measurable and help them achieve their desired outcome mm-hmm. consistently. Mm-hmm. Acidity is something we could measure more, you know, doing our TA of the must before pitching, mm-hmm. doing TA at day 5, day 10, day 15, and then further down the road. That would actually literally give us a measurement on, right now we're just doing pH, which is relative. And if we could do TA, that would give us a sense at the end of the fermentation, like how acidic is this relative to other meads of the style that we mm-hmm. made. And then does that sense of balance correlate to that number? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
then you start getting data points and your experience, you'd like kind of line it up.
Exactly. That's where the subjective piece comes in, right? It's like sometimes the numbers are all right, but it doesn't come together quite. And why was that? Mm-hmm. Versus like sometimes the numbers are off, but it comes together even better. And now it's like, oh, we've got a new target to shoot for.
Mm-hmm. What about for a new home mead maker? What tools do you think they need as a sort of bare minimum to have a balanced mead tool?
Yeah. Number one is a hydrometer and a cylinder, right? You've got to be able to measure your sugar before fermentation so you know what's possible. Given your yeast, different yeasts have different alcohol tolerances, and if you don't give them enough sugar, they'll eat all the way through it and you'll get something totally dry. Whereas if you just give them a little bit more than what they're able to tolerate, you'll have some residual sugar at the end, which will allow you to have a shot at balancing alcohol and sweetness without back sweetening. And I just don't like back sweetening because it introduces a ton of problems in terms of stability and flavor integration. Like back sweetening, the likelihood you're going to have a balanced sweetness profile is so low relative to if you start with a little more sugar and then the fermentation ends before all the sugar has been consumed.
So hydrometer,
cylinder,
that takes care of sweetness and alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And is there an easy way to measure total acidity, TA?
No, that's like a couple $100 at least of equipment, but a pH meter or pH strips even mm-hmm. like to be able to measure the difference between a 4.0 pH, which is like not going to be sweet at all. Right. Like I bet, or not going to be tart at all. Like I bet our sweet is coming in at 3.6 something, 3.7. We can look. Yeah. We do measure that stuff.
3.73 was the last one recorded.
Yeah. And our pH on the sour is like 3.4?
Yes, 3.43.
Yeah, so the relative pH of our sour, which is like puckeringly tart, and our sweet, which just has a little background acidity, is only 0.3 difference. Mm-hmm. And on a strip, like let's compare those two colors next to each other. And like, unless you've got a very zoomed in strip set, mm-hmm. it's going to be very hard to tell the difference. So buying a $90 pH pen is mm-hmm. at least a shot, but you have to maintain it.
Mm-hmm. You have to be calibrated, you know, pretty much every time you use it.
Yeah, so that's kind of rough. I mean, honestly, if you're good at pH meters or pH strips, like you should be able to tell the difference between 3.4 and 3.6. And like, if you want your sweeter stuff to not be so tart, like it should be 3.6 to 4. And if you want your more tart stuff, it should be like 3.4 to 3.2. But then if you get under 3.2, like you're retarding your yeast. So that's actually a super valuable thing. So yes, a $20 tube of winemaker pH strips mm-hmm. with like a range of 3 to 4.4 is I think worth investing in.
And is there any like objective way to measure tannins really, or is that just taste?
How do you measure tannins? I don't even pay attention to that, but I know there is a way. Yeah, you gotta talk to Shram or someone else who's more into the fruit meads and stuff about that. Taste is a big way to do it, and blending. Like, a lot of winemakers just go, whoa, that's way too much tannin in that barrel. And then they go blend it with neutral barrels of the same wine, and then it reduces it, you know, significantly. But there is some way to measure tannins. But yeah, I think that's like...
probably not at a home scale.
Definitely not, yeah.
So if someone wants to make mead, to measure their mead and ensure success, they need a hydrometer, which is, what, 50, 60 bucks?
Not even, I think.
20 bucks.
Yeah, 20 to 40.
A good one with a thermometer in it. It's a little more expensive, but you can, if you have another way of measuring temperature, you can get by. A cylinder,
yeah,
cheap.
That fits the hydrometer,
yeah,
and doesn't make too much waste, right? If you have a big old cylinder and a small hydrometer, you're going to be filling that tube up, and it's going to be wasting a ton of mead. Whereas if you have a cylinder that's like just wider than your hydrometer, that's kind of ideal. Mm-hmm. And like just as tall as your hydrometer, then you're going to be able to measure that density of that liquid without. But you do want enough room for the hydrometer to like allow the liquid out of the sides, right? You don't want it too tight so that the liquid gets stuck and then the pressure gradient stops the hydrometer from floating and doing its job.
Mm-hmm. But if someone goes to a homebrew store, they can usually
point them to the right set. Yeah.
And pH strips, super cheap. So making mead at home and measuring things that are important is very doable, where someone at home doesn't have to just like, well, I just have this mead in a bucket and I just let it go until it stops bubbling. That's not necessarily going to
end up with a good product. Yeah. And you need a scale to measure out your nutrients. Mm-hmm. But that's 20 bucks. And then a thermometer to measure your fermentation temp, or like a sticky thermometer on your carboy. Mm-hmm. So it's possible to make decent mead at home and be able to measure these things and improve them based off of your outcomes.
Awesome. All right.
Well, the next thing is a microscope. If you can drop $200 on a microscope and look at your yeast while they're fermenting, that is key, because that's how you know whether your yeast are healthy or not.
And if you are a home brewer with a microscope, you're better off than some
professional brewers. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's it. Thanks for talking about the meat stool.
Oh, thanks for letting me. I love that game. Cheers.
Cheers.
All right, that's a wrap on the meat stool concept. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us. We appreciate all the support we can get. If there's anything you'd like to know more about, feel free to email us at podcast@goldencoastmead.com with your questions, and we'll try to answer them to the best of our ability for you. Now here's your weekly bee joke. What's a bee's favorite song? Don't stop believing. Mead out.